The U.S. and Iran continue to trade attacks, with the region edging closer and closer to an all-out war. How does the history of these countries influence the current conflict? And how does the war redefine the future of Iranian politics and civil society? This week on Upfront, I'll be asking those questions to Iranian-American historian Mohammed Ali Kadivar. Mohammed Ali Kadivar, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Thank you very much for having me.
In escalating attacks over the last 2 weeks, we have seen the United States devastate Iran's civilian infrastructure, hitting bridges, airports, electrical facilities, a desalination plant. And we've also seen Iran respond, hitting U.S. allies in the Gulf and destabilizing and even destroying their civilian infrastructure, too. What do you make of this escalation? Will that move us toward a negotiation or toward an all-out war?
I mean, that's a question we are all asking ourselves today. There are, I think, either of the adversaries, Iran and the U.S., think this would give them a better hand when they go back to the negotiations. I think each side is estimating that they have endurance and they can impose a remarkable cost on the other side, and this risks going on to a forever war. And that is the concern, the miscalculations of the two sides and the cost that it is bringing on the civilians.
You said something in April that I thought was interesting. You said that attacks on Iran's civilian infrastructure suggested this war is not about degrading Iran's military or government,
yeah,
but degrading Iran basically as a nation state.
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
I mean, why else would we see attacks on hospitals or the Pasteur Institute, which is an old health institute in Iran that goes back to the end of the Qajar period? It was not even from the Pahlavi era. And that's where Iran developed its own vaccines that both for domestic use, Iran also imported some of the dosage of those vaccines. I probably have some of that in my body when I was a kid in Iran. Or attacking a power plant, a metal plant in Isfahan.
Well, you know what they're going to say. Bridges, electrical facilities, metal facilities, all this stuff are potential military targets. They're not trying to degrade Iran as a nation state. They're just trying to prevent any kind of buildup of military capacity.
And that's, I think, just a different language to say we are degrading Iran as a nation state. Because where is the boundary? With vaccines, you can tell also Iranians would get vaccine, and then some of them would go and build missiles or defenses, so on and so forth. So with that kind of language, I think the whole international law collapses in terms of protection of civilian infrastructure, because you can just make up some sort of reason that something is not civilian infrastructure. I think that has been defined by the law. It's not just up to the opinion of American or Iranian official to say what is civilian and what is not civilian.
We've seen the human toll of this war over the last few months. 3,000 Iranians killed, roughly half of them civilians, including more than 300 children. Two-thirds of buildings hit inside of Iran have been civilian, including hospitals and schools. You've spoken about your own high school being bombed. Yeah. And a recent U.S. strike hit near a pediatric cancer hospital, forcing the evacuation of 211 children who were undergoing treatment. Talk to me about the long-term impact of this kind of devastation.
I think that the impact is multidimensional. If you just focus on human costs, one, there, as I mentioned, there's unemployment, like millions of unemployment. So even if you're Iran and U.S. tomorrow come and negotiate and have a great deal and Iran gets sanction reliefs, this is not going to solve the damages that have been done on Iranian economy and Iranian infrastructure immediately. For relief to translate to production, for these factories come back to work, for employment to be added. So this is all going to take a long time to be repaired if we go to the path of recovery. We are not on the path of recovery. And there will be health consequences for attacking hospitals and health centers and so on. I don't know how Iran is going to now produce the vaccines that it needed. So we might see some sort of disease, for example, increasing in the coming years. Obviously, there would be psychological impact and trauma. We have seen this during the 1980s in Iran after Iran-Iraq war. I've done some work myself. Usually we see some of the psychological impact after the war is over. So after the war was over in Iran, we see that the suicide rate almost doubled in the country. This is also a global phenomenon. Usually during the war, communities stay together. It's like the state of emergency. It is usually after the war that the problems come up. And in Iran, it's documented the use of antidepressant medicine increase after Iran-Iraq war. So I expect to see that level of impact as well.
And that's if it stops now.
That is if it stops now. A forever war or a long chronic war would have even worse of these consequences. I mean, the other side of this is militarization of politics and society, which we can talk about what kind of political institutions take power. Obviously, it's military institutions in any context of any war. But even the public opinion changes in terms of defense, in terms of how much they trust those military institutions. We still have to wait for new research to be done. But from what we know from previous wars and in other countries, the expectation is that there would be more support for defense, also for IRGC, for the army.
And for strikes elsewhere.
Of course.
Right? I mean, and we've seen Iran respond.
Yeah.
In the Gulf, they're hitting civilian targets. They're hitting military targets. We expect the military stuff, but they've also hit power plants, water plants. In a country like Kuwait, for example, where you need a desalination plant just to meet the basic water needs of the people, how do we make sense of those attacks? We're particularly for those who are saying what's happening in Iran is problematic.
Yeah. What about yes, if we go, I think, just go to the international law, it's all problematic. Attacking civilian infrastructure is problematic. But who is holding the international law? Iran, I mean, the whole war was illegal. United States and Israel attacked Iran unprovoked. So in an ideal or alternative universe where there are international institutions, Iran goes to the United Nations or the Security Council and says, I've been attacked, please do something. There is no such thing here. Iran cannot go to any international institution. So the only way it has had to stop these attacks is by reciprocating. And I think the reciprocation has been, or retaliation has been overall measured. They have done mostly tit for tat. They have not done extensive destruction of civilian infrastructure. But this is devastating for the whole region. I don't think Iran eventually long-term benefits by having this type of retaliation and attacks on its neighbors. So it's neither good for the Gulf states, is nor good for Iran, is nor good for the U.S., but unfortunately we have been in this cycle for a long time.
And in the latest stage of fighting, at least four U.S. service members have died in Iraq and Jordan. That brings the total number to 18 since the war began in February. Now, President Trump has said that these deaths were done in service to the country. Can you reflect on what that means and help us think a bit, for those who don't know, what the U.S. presence in the region has meant historically?
So the presence, U.S. presence in the region continues the presence of Western powers in the region, which goes to different period for different parts. So the strongest presence of Western power in the region is from World War I. And the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Then at that time, Britain and France became the de facto empires in the region when the Ottoman collapsed. And then after World War II, when those two great powers declined, United States became their successor, and the United States continued the military operations in the region. And they haven't, none of them have been succeeded in bringing peace to the region. Every now and
then. Has that been the goal?
I think an empire usually is interested in bringing stability to the realm. So I think...
The reason I ask is there seems to be a difference maybe between stability and peace.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes the empire just wants kind of empire on the cheap. They want the kind of control of the region from a distance, but that usually comes at the expense of groups of people who are disenfranchised and therefore won't remain peaceful.
Yeah, so I think their ideal has been both peace and stability, but with domination. They wanted to dominate. But there have been resistances of different types, different ideologies at different eras. We have had Arab nationalism of Nasser, and then we have had political Islam of Ayatollah Khomeini's version and Islamic Republic and other offshoots of either of these currents. So these have provided different forms of resistance, and this has led to wars between Israel and the Arab states, now between Israel, United States, and Iran. So in that sense, it's a continuation of that imperialist military aggression and presence.
That context seems important to understand, because Western media, in some cases, will have you thinking that Iranians just hate the U.S., or that the U.S. troops are just being targeted and attacked in these areas for little reason.
Yeah.
When in fact, there's a significant, at least context.
No. The wars and sanctions and exploitations, these are not inventions or fabrications of Islamic Republic. This is not some fictional stories. When we go back to the start of 19th century up to this moment, I think every Iranian that has lived at least 40 years has witnessed two wars in there. I mean, I don't know how to count the recent wars between Iran and the U.S. Is it all? But let's count this as one. I witnessed this, and I also was born and lived under Iran-Iraq war. But starting from the early 19th century, we have the Perso-Russian wars, in which Iran lost territory, all the Caucasus, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Armenia on the other side, Turkmenistan, to the Russian Empire and then later Soviet Union. Then we had Herat was separated in Iran. That was war with Britain mid-19th century. Later we have World War I, which came after the Constitutional Revolution. And then we have Reza Shah and centralization of power in his hand. We have central government becoming powerful. But then his newly built army cannot resist World War II and the occupation of the country when he was removed again in 1941. At that period, we have an episode of regime change when United States and other Western power and Soviet came. They removed Reza Shah. They put his son Mohammad Reza, the young king. We have between 1941 and 53 a period of elite contestation and public participation. It leads to nationalization of oil in 1951, and then we have the coup in 1953. So now there is not much talk about regime change, but a few months ago was.
Yes. There are many people who aren't necessarily even pro-Trump.
Yeah.
But because Trump said that regime change was a key dimension of the intervention in Iran, they were supporting Trump. And if they weren't supporting Trump, they were at least optimistic about the outcomes. And then after Iran cracks down on protesters, they said, oh yeah, we really need regime change. Regime change is coming.
Yeah.
As you just said, not much promise for regime change now. And even removing the Ayatollah and replacing him with a younger, stronger, more emboldened Ayatollah, what does this mean? Is the faith gone?
I think it looks like that the United States concluded that regime change is not a plausible scenario. But this was something experts were saying, the scholars or analysts.
The scholars and the experts for a minute. The Iranian people were literally supporting, pumping their fists for Trump. Again, not because they necessarily love Trump, but because they wanted regime change. You're somebody who argues for regime change.
We have to define regime change. I have championed, I want to see democratic government in Iran, secular government in Iran, but the path we take to that matters. I don't think American bombs or Israeli bombs.
You can't bomb your way to regime change.
No. I mean, I have written a whole book about it, what sets a path to durable democracy, and that is bottom-up protest, organizing, coalition building, and mobilization. It's the path of democratization from top history has shown us is not a plausible path.
But you're a trained historian. What do the rank-and-file everyday Iranian people say right now as they're watching their dreams of regime change through Trump maybe fade away?
So there is not one Iranian people. Iranian society is a diverse society, is a heterogeneous society, and when it comes to some of these topics, it's polarized at this point. It's polarized, yes, because when Ayatollah Khamenei was killed, some Iranians were happy and were celebrating. And then we also watched his massive funeral that, of course, was organized by the state in Iran, where millions of people participated. So I think there are a lot of people who may not be happy, or they are dissatisfied with Islamic Republic, or may even want a different type of political life or regime in Iran, but they do not support this war. They do not want to see a foreign government comes and use the pretext of liberation to liberate Iranians. But yeah, some Iranians supported the war position, and it's interesting to look how it worked. There were foreign-funded TVs that were presenting that had years of propaganda. Part of the propaganda was to say that nothing has worked in Iran. No protests, no demonstrations has resulted in anything, which is false. They have not resulted in the fall of the regime, but that is a very specific metric to measure success of different social movements. Protests and social movements have had incremental achievements in Iran, if we look back in the last few decades. We can go into detail, but just to give you one small example, is women's hijab and scarf. This was a pillar of Islamic Republic's ideology and how they wanted to organize society.
Yeah.
Well, we know there were the protests in 2022, which emboldened women that before the protest, they didn't cover some of their hair. After the protest, the boundary changed. Women just stopped covering, many women stopped covering any of their hair and not wearing mandatory hijab. And the state struggled with, they were back and forth, but they came to the conclusion that they cannot enforce this. And they de facto, the laws are still about pro-hijab, but de facto they have accepted the fact that we can't do anything about this. And it came to the fact that the parliament passed a bill to penalize not wearing hijab and give fine to those women, but president said, President Pezeshkian didn't sign this, said this would turn to a matter of national security. So these changes have happened. It has not led to the collapse of Islamic Republic, and I can mention other changes of this scale.
But as you said, it's incremental.
It's incremental, and they're back and forth. Sometimes a social movement, society, a group has an achievement, and then it is reversed, but then they take it back. So
part of why that happens, I would imagine, is collective memory. There are a lot of people still holding on, as you referenced earlier, to the Iran-Iraq war. A lot of devastation, a lot of pain, a lot of trauma. How do those memories shape people's willingness or unwillingness to see resistance now, to see war now?
The Iran-Iraq war legacies, I think, have been different for different parts of the state and society. So it has shaped very much the thinking of Iranians, top elite, all these commanders of Revolutionary Guards, even civilian officials. We have President Pezeshkian himself was in charge of the hospitals and health situation at war. Or Foreign Minister Araghchi had his own engagements before. So it has, because the Iran-Iraq war was fought in a way that Iran was didn't have any real alliances and coalitions. There was a much more international support behind Iraq, even Soviet, United States, and Europe at different times. So this shaped the siege mentality of Iranian elite and how they're alone in whatever they're doing. I think for Iranian people, a lot of people, I think they don't want to go back to that experience, because the time of Iran-Iraq war was also a time of austerity. A large part of the state's revenues was spent on the war. But how that war was fought has been also debated. So earlier on, I was talking about possible miscalculation. On the Iranian side, we now see some references to that period. And there are two important turning points. So initially, Iraq invades Iran in 1980, and even though Iranians put up a fierce resistance, this led to some loss of territory. The major place was the city of Khorramshahr. that was occupied by Iraqis. It took a few years for Iranians to assemble their forces and take that city back. And that is a moment that was a moment of decision for Iranian officials, whether to end the war, because there were some proposals of peace, or continue an offensive into the Iraqi territory. Eventually, they decided to go on the offensive. I think this must be in 1981 or 1982. And initially, they had this big ambition of toppling Saddam Hussein. Later, they changed that to have one decisive strategic victory, such as capturing Basra, for example. They even went lower than that. Later, they captured the island of Fav, but they couldn't keep that. So from 82, I think, to 88, war went on. Majority of casualties on the Iranian side are in that offensive phase of the war. And that strategic victory was never achieved. Hmm. So that's why I'm concerned, and I also see this voice of concern from inside Iran, that these miscalculations have been made before, and in any strategic game, you have to call it at some point.
For sure.
And you don't know about the future, so you have to make that decision, and always fighting for a better deal or better victory in the future, it's a gamble.
Your book, Popular Politics and the Path to Durable Democracy, takes a look at the success of sustained, organized, pro-democracy movements across different countries. And I thought this was interesting. There have been periods of protest movements in Iran that have gained global attention. I'm thinking about the 2009 Green Movement, the 2022 Women, Life, Freedom, and also the anti-government protests in 2017, 2018, 2019 as well, and of course this January. Were any of these movements, particularly Iran's previous protest movements, that were successful in helping us change the political norms?
So it again goes back to my earlier point. How do we define success? Is success the collapse of Islamic Republic and a transition to democracy? This has not happened. But as I mentioned in the example of women's hijab and 2022 protest, I would say yes, these protests have had consequences. So I mentioned the women protests. You mentioned 2009. So when these protests happen, the state's immediate response is always repression. But it's not only repression. Usually afterwards, they think about how we can incorporate or compromise or give something to these protesters, but not to give them what that they want. What is it that we can give to them that would work for us also? Mm. So 2009 protests were about fraud in the election, and the opposition leaders of that time were put under house arrest. They're under house custody until today. But since then, there has not been fraud in Iranian elections. The elections have not been democratic. They still decide who runs.
I was going to say, they haven't been fraudulent, but they also haven't been.
Yeah, but 2009 was, they also restricted in terms of who can enter. And then the ballots were not counted, at least. We don't know the results that were announced were actually the ballots that were counted. So that has not happened since. Second was in 2013, the establishment allowed Hassan Rouhani to run and become president. Again, Hassan Rouhani was not someone, was not a champion of 2009 protests. He was a moderate conservative. But he was that compromise that the state's elite or the establishment was willing. So in that sense, protests have had consequences.
Before you go, I want to end where we began.
Yeah.
We're on the precipice of a forever war or a peace deal, potentially. Based on your knowledge of history, based on the facts on the ground, based on your understanding and your own experience as an Iranian, which way are we leaning?
I mean, I hope we lean towards peace, but I'm really concerned that we wouldn't get there anytime soon. I mean, we talked about Iran-Iraq war. It dragged for 8 years, and it didn't have to go that long. So I think I'm concerned at this point.
Thank you for your honesty. Muhammad Ali Khalivar, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Thank you very much for having me.